doubt is a glorious reminder of our limitations as human beings, of how little we can ever know, of how suspicious we should always be of certainty. At my convent boarding school, we grew up with doubt, capitalised, like God.
The essay, including contributions by Susan Greenfield.
Doubt in science is integral, not so much to what scientists do, but to how we think.
And Alistair Campbell.
Did they just say Alistair Campbell? What does he know about self-doubt?
The essay, The Case for Doubt. Weeknights this week at 10:45 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, the time now is just after 1 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's time now for the news with David Cornett.
A peace plan brokered by the international envoy Kofi Annan to end the conflict in Syria has run into trouble 2 days before it's due to come into effect. The Syrian Foreign Ministry has said the government won't withdraw its forces from towns and cities unless opposition groups give written guarantees to stop the fighting. Anti-government activists say that as many as 160 people died yesterday on one of the bloodiest days of the Syrian uprising. Activists say many of the deaths were in the western city of Hama, which has been shelled by government forces. The Pope has used his Easter Sunday message to urge the Syrian regime to end bloodshed and to commit to dialogue. The Vatican says he'll visit Lebanon for 3 days in September on his second foreign trip this year. In his last Easter message before he stands down, the Archbishop of Canterbury also touched on the Middle East, saying that the daily harassment and humiliation of Palestinians at Israeli checkpoints can't be a justifiable price to pay for security. Government ministers have condemned the hacking group Anonymous, which claims to have launched an online attack on the Home Office website. The site was disrupted for several hours last night, but it's now operating normally. Anonymous says it took the action in protest at government extradition and surveillance policies. A man has been charged with a public order offence after yesterday's university boat race was disrupted by a protester. Trenton Oldfield will appear before magistrates later this month. A cruise ship, which will follow the same route as that of the Titanic, sets sail from Southampton this afternoon, almost exactly 100 years after the ship hit an iceberg and sank. The MS Balmoral will carry more than 1,300 people, including scores of relatives of those who died in the disaster. And the weather, it'll be rather cloudy with outbreaks of rain and drizzle, particularly across southeast England and some western areas. Heavier rain will reach the northwest later today and will spread southeast overnight. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
Read by David Cornett. I'm Jill Anderson. Good afternoon to you. At 2 o'clock this afternoon, our Sunday concert will be given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Davis. There are two works in their programme. First of all, Hugh Wood's violin concerto, and Anthony Marwood will be the violin soloist. And then we'll hear a performance of Michael Tippett's A Child of Our Time. The vocal soloists will be Nicole Cabell, Karen Cargill, John Mark Ainsley and Matthew Rose with the BBC Symphony Chorus. That's our Sunday concert starting at 2 o'clock. But now it's time to join Lucy Skeeping for a seasonal early music show.
Thank you. joyful Kyrie to open today's programme. Rather Vivaldi-ish, wasn't it? But no, it's not remotely Venetian, or even Italian for that matter. It's by a composer from further north, Willem de Fes, part of his Easter Mass for Antwerp Cathedral in 1730, and possibly written as some kind of peace offering because just a few months earlier, poor old de Fes had fallen out with the church authorities. He continued to have quite a dodgy relationship with the cathedral, but for now at least, all was forgiven and he was paid handsomely for his work. Well, in keeping with the season, we're featuring music for Easter all through today's early music show. The story of the betrayal, the trial and crucifixion of Jesus has inspired composers to create some of their most personal and reflective works. In ancient times, the Passion would simply be chanted by a single voice. By the Middle Ages, three priests would deliver the text, one singing the narrative, one the words of Christ, and the third providing the voices of the crowd. With the Renaissance came harmony and four-part choruses. And eventually instruments would colour the text as well, along with chorales, which the congregation would join in, so that they themselves could literally become part of the story. For the next piece, we're in the Sicilian town of Palermo. The year is 1714, and one Francesco Scarlatti, the younger brother of the better-known Alessandro, is frantically putting the finishing touches to a new work. He'd been a member of the orchestra at the Royal Court in Naples, but now in his mid-twenties and married, he'd returned to his hometown, where his Miserere would be given at the Easter service. It's such lovely music that it's hard to imagine just why his efforts as a composer weren't fully appreciated during his lifetime. From the imperial court in Vienna to the English household of Handel's one-time employer, the Duke of Chandos, this Scarlatti was passed over again and again for the jobs he sought. Nevertheless, this Miserere certainly is a glorious contribution to the Easter repertoire. And we'll hear the final section, Gloria Patri.
So
Gloria Patri, the final part of Miserere Mei Deus by Francesco Scarlatti, first performed in Palermo in 1714. Our next Easter music isn't only from an earlier period, from the first years of the 1600s, but it's much more solemn in character. It's part of the Tenebrae responses by a composer whose own life was also full of extreme sadness and anguish. Carlo Gesualdo was born into privilege, the upper-class world of Naples. Always interested in the latest developments in music, he lived for a time in Ferrara, where he experimented with concertos and madrigals, in particular the quite new idea of word painting, where the meaning of the texts led the music rather than the other way round. But his fragile mental state and dangerously flaky lifestyle led him eventually to become a recluse. And it was in his final tortured years, holed up in his castle in the mountains around Avellino, that he produced the work that stands out as his masterpiece, his setting of the Tenebrae responses. This is certainly his most intensely personal music. Tenebrae means darkness, and the darkness of the church itself, as by tradition the candle lights were extinguished one by one to symbolise the growing darkness of the world as Jesus is betrayed, crucified and buried. The atmosphere is one of solemn ritual, not for Gesualdo to trumpet the glorious brilliance of the resurrection, but to chronicle the darkest night of the Christian soul, and with it perhaps to dig deeper into his own torment. All you who walk by on the road, pay attention and see if there be any sorrow like my sorrow. O Vos Omnes, part of Gesualdo's setting of the Tenebrae responses. The Gesualdo consort was directed by Gerald Place. The Lamentations of Jeremiah are musical settings from the biblical Book of Lamentations. In sorrowful tones, they describe the destruction of Jerusalem and the fall of Judea. And since at least part of the text comes from actual eyewitness accounts, it's highly emotional and rich in imagery, portraying a timeless kind of mourning that was so inspirational to medieval and Renaissance composers. But perhaps it's the early polyphonic settings, without any frills or ornamentation, that create the strongest effect. When singing lamentations, instructed one writer at the time, choristers should take care not to sing a single ornament, lest the sorrowful character turns to joyful mood. He might well have been describing this next setting, which is by a composer who spent the first part of his life as a monk in the austerity of a closed community. Tiburzio Masaino went on to work as a singer in Cremona, the court of Innsbruck, in Salzburg, and in Prague, where he was a member of the court chapel. But in 1599, he returned to Italy, where his Lamentations were published. You'll hear he uses a rich palette of harmonies, beautifully performed here by the Huelgas Ensemble, directed by Paul van Nevel. How does the city sit solitary that was full of people? All her friends have become her enemies. Jerusalem, convert to your Lord. The opening section of the Lamentations of Jeremiah for Maundy Thursday, set by Tiburcio Masaino and published in the last year of the 16th century. Paul Van Nevel directed the Huelgas Ensemble. In this next set, we're going to hear a piece that belongs to the Saturday service, Easter Eve. Jacobus Hendel Gallus is the composer, born in Slovenia, but like so many talented young musicians, he travelled first to Austria for some serious study with the monks at the Benedictine Abbey at Melk, and then onto a sort of monastery crawl around Bohemia and Silesia, absorbing everything he could about church music. His Lamentations probably date from his stay in Prague around the 1580s. Might be my imagination, but it does seem to have quite an Eastern feel, although, of course, Gallus's style is actually nearer the Venetian school, as was the fashion. First of all, though, part of the setting of the Good Friday service from about 50 years earlier by Jan Dismas Zelenka. He spent much of his life at the court of Dresden, and although his music is still very recognisably Catholic, you can make a comparison with Bach. They were almost exact contemporaries and both continued to compose in a contrapuntal, fugal style that certainly by the 1730s already felt quite old-fashioned. In other ways, though, Zelenka's Lamentations moved away from the old traditions. Since the Middle Ages, it had been the custom to begin each section of them with a Gregorian chant on one of the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. But here we find not so much a simple one-line melody, but a series of melismatic passages. And the refrain that concludes each day's text, Jerusalem, turn to the Lord your God, that's also given a more rhetorical weight than you might expect at this time. In fact, this attention to words was very encouraged at Dresden. In fact, it was only a few years earlier that Zelenka's successor declared that a composer could only really move the audience's emotions through what he called refined expression of the text itself. The soloist here is John Mark Ainslie.
Thank you.
Lamentations for the Easter Eve service by Jacobus Händel Gallus, performed by the Czech Philharmonic Chorus of Brno, directed by Petr Fila. And before that, we heard John Mark Ainsley with the Shandos Baroque Players in part of Jan Dismas Zelenka's Lamentations for Good Friday. I'm Lucy Skeeping, and in this Easter Eve early music show, we're hearing some seasonal music from the Renaissance and Baroque periods. And amongst some of the more rarely heard works, we couldn't possibly leave out what's become one of the most popular for this time of the year, Per Gelese's extraordinary Stabat Mater. We've only time here for part of it today, I'm afraid, because there's just so much more I want to play you. But if you haven't come across it, I think you'll agree it really is something special. The text comes from a 13th century hymn to the Virgin, the image of a grieving mother standing beside the cross where her son is dying a slow and painful death. And Per Gelese, already a successful opera composer, injected it with all the drama of a theatre work. It opens with a haunting string procession. We feel the pain of Mary as she stands by the cross in a series of clashing, interlocking dissonances. What mother would not weep to see the mother of Christ in such agony, dying and forsaken while he gave up his spirit? Talin Lyrique, directed by Christophe Rousset, with the first movement of Pere Galaise's Stabat Mater. At the cross stood the mournful mother, weeping close at last to her son. And we hear similar words in a very different setting now. Antonio Lotti's motet Crucifixus, performed here by the 16. Lotti was director of music at St Mark's in Venice, but he was also a very skillful opera composer. And although here he gives us long, slow lines, there is nothing staid about it. Instead, a sense of real drama as the volume builds towards the final line. He died and was buried, before it closes with a calm tranquillity. The 16, directed by Harry Christophers, with Lotti's Crucifixus. Well, for our next music, we look not to a choir, but to a purely instrumental piece, and another Czech-born composer, Heinrich Ignaz Franz Bieber. Having shown a precocious talent as a violinist, Bieber eventually settled in Salzburg, where he quickly rose through the ranks to become conductor of the court orchestra. And it was here that he produced a set of violin sonatas that weren't only brilliant, but unique in that they require the instrument to be tuned in several different ways. The collection is known as the Rosary Sonatas, each one based on one of the mysteries of the Rosary. Perhaps Bieber himself performed them during the Festival of the Rosary, which was held in October. We're going to hear the 11th sonata. It's full of unusual sounds and decorations, but in the middle section you'll hear a melody coming through. It's an Easter hymn tune from Poland that no doubt the audience would have recognised. Gradually, though, the playing, laced with so many chords, builds to a climax as if to emphasise the miracle of the resurrection.
Thank you.
the 11th of Bieber's so-called Rosary Sonatas, portraying the crucifixion. Michaela Decanetti was the violinist, with Max Engel on the cello and the organist Franz Lehrendorfer. Well, there's just time for one more piece of early Easter music, and I'd like to bet that it's by a composer that's new to you. She certainly was to me, and yes, I did say she. The memorably named Sulpizia Chasis was indeed a woman, an Italian lutenist who at the age of 16 was plonked by her father into a convent in Modena. Although this may seem harsh, it was this life that actually enabled her to develop her talents. The convent was particularly musical, and Sulpizia's collection of motets gives us an idea of the sort of repertoire that was sung by nuns during the early 1600s. They're for 2 to 12 voices, some dedicated to various saints, some for specific seasons like Christmas or Easter, which we'll hear now. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to the Palace of the Sepulchre. It is Jesus whom you seek. He is not here. He has risen, as he said, and goes before you to Galilee. There you will see him.
Maria Magdalena by Sulpizia Chasis. The performers were Capella Artemisia, directed by Candace Smith. And that ends today's Early Music Show. It was presented by Lucy Skeeping. Well, at 4 o'clock this afternoon, we've a live choral evensong from Gloucester Cathedral, and we'll be hearing music by Herbert Howells, Samuel Wesley and Charles-Marie Vidor, among others. That's 4 o'clock this afternoon.
To Nimrod, this was Elgar at his most Wagnerian.
Since Parsifal, nothing of this mystic, religious kind of music has appeared to my knowledge that displays the same power and beauty as yours.
And with his close friend August Jaeger's help and coercion, the young composer created a glorious music drama, a personal yet universal celebration of faith. The dream of Gerontius, from a city that has made it its own. The City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, with a cast of soloists, including Sarah Connolly. Thursday night's Radio 3 live in concert on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30.
Well, the time now is a couple of minutes after 2 o'clock, and time for our Sunday concert, which took place at the Barbican last month. It's introduced by Penny Gore.
Welcome to the Barbican Hall in the heart of the City of London, where the BBC Symphony Orchestra is about to be reunited with its conductor laureate, Sir Andrew Davis, in a programme of 2 major pieces. Later we'll hear Michael Tippett's great wartime oratorio, A Child of Our Time, with the BBC Symphony Chorus and a stellar cast of soloists. But first, the distinguished violinist Anthony Marwood joins the orchestra in a work receiving its London premiere. The 2nd violin concerto by the Lancashire-born Hugh Wood, who celebrates his 80th birthday this year. The piece took time to come to fruition. Wood started work on it in 2002, having decided to write a new concerto for his one-time pupil at Cambridge, Alexandra Wood. With her duo partner, Hugh Watkins, she'd already given the first performance of Hugh Wood's poem for violin and piano. The new piece took shape slowly. It was officially finished in 2004, but as Hugh Wood cheerfully admits, much revision was necessary. In fact, he made a radical reshaping of the 3 movements, and especially the finale, which he cut down dramatically to a much more concise form. I asked Hugh Wood whether he enjoyed the process of composing this concerto.
It was hell. It was terrible. It always is, every time. And if it sounds spontaneous, it's because of the risk to life and limb which it's involved, honestly. There's a marvellous quotation from Verdi. He goes through all the virtues of writing a scene in opera and all the qualities that it should have. And he ends up by saying, all this must seem easy, 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 but doing it is difficult, difficult, difficult. I mean, you know, it's a bit like sort of a woman after childbirth. She can't remember the things she's sort of gone through. Else she'd never have any more babies, really. But there are these occasional good moments when you get a given, a donné, something which you didn't ask for, which just came. But boy, are they rare. Mostly it's done by crossing out what you did yesterday and substituting something else, which will then be crossed out again tomorrow. The free lunches don't come very often.
Hugh Wood. In its new incarnation, the concerto's first movement shows off the soloist's lyrical prowess, as the violin part seems to climb heavenwards, to be brought down to earth by the orchestra, though with 2 cadenzas allowing the violin to reassert itself. There are 2 main themes in the central slow movement, in the violin's highest and lowest registers, although you'll hear cor anglais, horn and woodwind restating both of them. And in the finale, Wood says, there's a slightly Spanish tinge in between returns of the themes heard earlier in the piece. Quartets of cellos and horns introduce a long coda, joined by all the violins and then by the soloist. Trumpet fanfares sound, and as brass and xylophone add their voices, the concerto comes to what its composer describes as a triumphant ending. And coming on stage now, Anthony Marwood with Sir Andrew Davis for this London premiere performance of the Violin Concerto No. 2 by Hugh Wood.